Hello, this is Sarah Pascoe. This is episode 8 of Sex, Power, Money, the podcast. Thank you so much for listening. Today, I'm talking to a woman called Fern Champion. Now, Fern actually reached out to me last year by email. We didn't know each other, but because I was doing this podcast, she had a lot of feelings about things that should be talked about more widely and people should know about. And it's based on her own experience, which is as a rape survivor. So we are going to be talking about her work today, but we are not going to be talking in any detail about assault. There's no specifics about assault, but I wanted to let you know that the topic is around that area. If after listening to the episode you want to find out more about Fern's experience, she has written about that and blogged about it online, and I will put the links to that in the show notes, or you could Google her name and find it that way. I hope you find the episode very interesting. I think there's an assumption that people think, because they know that like rape crisis centres exist, and I think they assume that if someone is assaulted, raped, there's somewhere for them to go. And actually what you found is that isn't true.
Yeah, no, massively. That was that was pretty much the whole point of why I started the work that I've been doing over the last few years, is that, yeah, precisely that. We have this assumption that if a woman is raped or assaulted, the support is just there for her, and no, that isn't true, and it isn't true to such an extent that those resources are so finite that they don't even exist anymore. For me, I keep trying to work out where my story started.
I'll ask questions. So, Fern, before your experience, before your experience, had you already kind of explored anything in terms of like rape support? Did you know about it as a genre, or were you quite oblivious?
I think I was aware. Like, I would certainly, I was a feminist, you know, like I, I was aware of the statistics around, rape convictions, I would say.
Yes.
I knew it was a pretty grim picture out there, in terms of, like survivors of rape. And I probably could have maybe guessed that provisions weren't as they should be, but I probably, I don't think it would have crossed my mind that it would have been, the picture would have been as bad as it was, to the extent that they're inaccessible, you know, like waiting lists are closed. And that was the message that I really wanted to drive home to people, is that even now, like the news report, you know, 6,000 women, men, women and children are on rape crisis waiting lists. That isn't really the story. The story is that those waiting lists are closed. There are thousands of women and people who can't access those waiting lists.
Yeah, so I didn't know that until your information came through to me, until we started talking. I had assumed that a waiting list was infinite, that it might be very, very long.
Yeah.
But what you wouldn't have when somebody calls up and says, hey, I need you, the answer is, we're not, you can't even wait for us. We're just not here.
Yeah. Yeah, well, yeah. Because what? So what? These services found themselves in the position of being in for such a long time now, is that like we're in an era with like Me Too, and especially since Jimmy Savile, where we have so much more of an understanding now of what is sexual abuse, sexual violence, sexual misconduct, and women are coming forward about their experiences, and so these services are overwhelmed with people coming forward and saying, like, look, this is what's happened to me, but there isn't the provision there to follow through to meet that demand. And so these centres, these rape crisis centres, they can't keep saying to these women, okay, we'll help you, but in 6 months' time, in 9 months' time, in 12 months' time, in, you know, it has to, they have a responsibility, I guess, at some point to say, we have to say no. We have to say we're realistically, we can't do it. And that was, again, something really important to me that I wanted to like get to the bottom of when I was trying to understand, when I was bouncing from like East London rape crisis to South London rape crisis, and they're saying exactly the same thing, like, we're so sorry, because they were sorry, like, there was that was the message I was getting, like, they wanted to help but they just couldn't. And I was like, I didn't want, my anger wasn't at them, I was like, I wanted to understand why, like, why can't you help? This is clearly a massive problem. The fact that you are overwhelmed with people asking you for help shows that there's an overwhelming need for you. So why isn't the provision there to help you support these people? Like, I did, that's what I needed to get to the bottom of.
Yeah. It seems like there's this area where we all think that, oh, I think it's getting better. As you say, like post Me Too, post Jimmy Savile, there's this conversation which seems to be, I mean, in some ways it's very upsetting knowing the extent of sexual transgressions, predators, child abuse, rapists, but it feels like society is having the blinkers taken off. It affects so many people. It's so common. People, like survivors of it, like, needn't have to deal with it by themselves. So this encouragement to come forward. So that part is improving, but the other part has actually become, as in the other half of it, where the support comes from, has not only not been able to meet supply and demand, as you say, they're overwhelmed, but also they've actually had their funding cut. So actually we have less rape crisis centres now than we did before the kind of the Tory coalition, whenever that was, 10 years ago. So the last decade, actually, there's less and less support for people, and especially like kind of provided support.
This is an issue that women's services have been bringing to the forefront for such a long time. And we are obligated to meet this demand, but under the Istanbul Convention, which we really signed up to in like 2012.
So the Istanbul Convention is the name that's given to the Council of Europe Convention on Preventing and Combating Violence Against Women and Domestic Violence. And so it was opened for signature on the 11th of May 2011 in Istanbul in Turkey. As of March 2019, it's been signed by 45 countries and the European Union.
And that sets out what we need to do in order to meet the demands with rape crisis centres. So we need 150 rape crisis centres in this country to meet the demand, but we only have 44. So that's such a tangible, like, you can see it. You can see what we need and you can see what we have. So therefore, we should be working towards fixing it. But we're not. We're doing the opposite. Like you say, we're getting rid of them. We have a huge, huge funding gap where we need like to be spending year on year, like 190 million on these services. And that will cover, it's not just sexual violence. You know, you can be covering women's services that can be dealing with domestic violence, domestic abuse as well. And at the time I launched the petition, we were spending 20 million. And every funding increase that they announced, like, it's not an increase. Like, that's money you've already set aside for it. We had the situations that come to light with the pandemic and with COVID, where of course women were who are already in vulnerable situations are going to be made even more vulnerable. So women in like violent relationships or women at risk of already at heightened risk of domestic abuse. We've seen increases of rates of reports of domestic abuse to domestic abuse charities, and so the government responded with like the emergency funding increase of like 70 million, and we're like, oh wow, that's a load of money, that's so much money, and that's meant to make us feel like, okay, we're winning, they're taking this seriously, but you look at the money, that's not money, that's like nothing. When you look at like all of the money that has gone into all of the emergency measures that we're putting into keeping everyone going and like keeping the country going, which of course you're doing, like we need to, of course, like over £100 billion, whatever has been put into keeping businesses going, like before the end of April, that no one had to even think twice about doing that. But you're only going to put £70 million of that to stop women getting keep women safe. Well, because like these numbers are so silly, they don't mean anything.
Yeah, I think that's the thing, is that, I mean, to anyone who is a lay person, 70 million sounds like such a huge amount of money. That you think, wow, I mean, you should be able to build everyone who isn't safe a house. You think that should solve all the problems. But it's only, and this is why we need experts or especially people from the sector to say, well, actually, like you say, if what they're supposed to give under the Istanbul Convention is 200 million, then actually that 70, which is still a deficit. That still means that the basics can't be met. That still means that there are people that can't be helped. And so there must be such a crossover actually in terms of people whose home situation isn't safe, that have are stuck with an aggressor in the house. And then, because I mean, which often quite involves rape as well, like domestic abuse relationships. Yeah. So there's a crossover, isn't there, of people who need support.
Yeah, well, I think that is the crux of it, really. It's about how we build how we've built our society and who we centered it around. Like rape survivors or people who are at risk of abusive relationships of any kind. They're in these abusive situations that make them vulnerable, and we haven't built our society around protecting them, and so like this is what I've really been trying to drill down to, what I've been trying to understand, like why aren't we listening? Because we get halfway there, and I felt it myself. Like I get there, I've been to number 10. Like I've been there. I've been in Margaret Thatcher's room, not her bedroom. I did all the walking around there, like Hugh Grant, like,
And what did they say to you? So when you spoke to politicians, what did they say to you?
I don't know. It was bollocks. That's the point. Created this, they're presented with a problem women are vulnerable and are getting raped. What can we do about it?
Some specific statistics for you here. I got these from rapecrisis.org. They were taken from the Crime Survey for England and Wales of 2017. 31% of women 18 to 24 report sexual abuse in childhood. 20% of women and 4% of men had experienced some kind of sexual assault since 16 years old.
Like the way we deal with the funding provision of rape crisis or any kind of like women's services, it's a complete mess. Like you can't unfathom it. You can't navigate yourself around it. And like they created that. Like they did that. They did it on purpose. And you've got to kind of ask yourself, why? Like, why did you do that? And so, like, I am kind of really interested in, like getting an understanding of that, because I don't want to attack people. Like, I don't want to come in at, you know, the Tories and say, girl, you're Tories.
Okay. Yeah.
Why aren't you, why do you hate me? Why do you hate women? Mm. Like, I don't want to do that because, like, I don't think that's going to open constructive conversation. Hello.
Sure. So it's my dog growling. He does hate the Tories. He just hears the name and he's, like, furious.
Yeah, fantastic. Well done.
I absolutely understand what you're saying, is that it becoming party political seems to, like, undermine the actual thing. So it's not about which party's in power. It's about what people need. Yeah,
exactly. Like the rape isn't a party political issue. I don't really care who's prime minister, who's in government. If you're not funding the services, then the women, like, they're not. It's not working, is it? Like, there's still people aren't getting the help.
Your experience, which you've written about, and you've written some brilliant articles that people could go away and read. You wrote one for The Secret Barrister about your experience, if people wanted to go away and read something after this. Just a reminder, Fern and I don't speak in specific detail about her assault and what happened to her. She does write about it herself very openly. I didn't feel like I wanted to force her to go through it. And also, you know, I'm not a trained psychologist. I'm a comedian doing a podcast. So I wanted to be really, you know, respectful as well. But if you do want to find out more about Fern's story, she's written articles and you can find those in the show notes. When you had the experience of crisis centres not being available to you, you were on a year's waiting list in another country. So that's right. And then when you came home, did you presume it would be easier?
Yeah, I think so. I knew I'd have to wait because, as you said, I'd already been waiting for a year overseas. But I didn't think I'd be turned away.
Yeah.
I just,
when they explained to you, oh, actually, we can't even put you on a waiting list, did they offer any alternative? Like, what do they recommend people do? Because they must realise the bravery, because there are people who don't even reach out to support services. It takes, I think, a really brave person to reach out and say, can you help me? Can I speak to you? Can we go through this together? Did they kind of say?
Like, yes and no, because they also know that there isn't really anything that they can, that there wasn't anything they could put me onto. So a couple of times, because again, this is going on for like a long time. It was about 8 months I was asking for help, and it would have been, it was repeatedly, like, I was calling again and again. So I was told to try my GP. I was told to try going via like victim support. And through another local, from a local council. Even when they were saying, like, these are options you can try, but we have to be realistic. Like, we don't know if you're going to be able to get what you need through these options. So, it's just a pretty, it's just grim. Like, it's just really grim.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really grim. And so the reason they say to go to a GP, is that because then the NHS provide other kinds of, like, counselling and therapy?
But, yeah, the NHS is like another way for you to access, like, because it's specialist treatment you need. Like, it's trauma. Like, you are processing and recovering from a trauma, and that needs medical treatment. That should be something realistically that, like, the NHS should be, like, your first kind of go-to for that. Like, in my mind, like, logically, because you're trying to treat something that's happened to you. I eventually got my therapy via a private therapist, so I didn't go through the NHS, but I'm not aware of it being like a much easier route via the NHS. Yeah. But I didn't, I couldn't access it.
Yeah. Well, so that's something that's actually really fascinating. And I think you write about, when I was reading some of the stuff you sent me yesterday, you described yourself as privileged, right? Which is something you wouldn't expect someone who'd been through what you have been through to ever say about themselves. Like, oh, actually, I'm lucky. And the reason is that you can tell people, so it was because of your employer.
Yeah.
So do you want to describe what happened?
Yeah. Thank you for paying so much attention to the things I sent you.
of course.
So, I mean, again, that was like such a huge reason as to why I wanted to speak out in the way I did. It's because the only reason that I got help in the end is because my employer stepped in. I just got to the point where I was like crashing through rock bottom, like really quite drastically. I'd been back in the UK for about 8 months, and during that whole time I'd been like just reaching out, like calling, like flip-flopping between like rape crisis and rape crisis, trying to just get help, and being told that they couldn't help me. I obviously had come back to the UK, so I was settling them back in, like starting a new job, like trying to like moving back to London, just rebuilding my life generally. It was a bit of a time, and I have like really awful migraines anyway, and these were just like off the scale. And like this, the whole like bubble I think I'd created for myself during the whole time that I stayed away, like after like the year after my like the rape, I think it was just very visibly kind of like cracking around me. So I just was getting like a lot of migraines, like I wasn't sleeping, that's like my getting really awful nightmares, like flashbacks, and so like I think the PTSD was just like very much rearing its head. And it got to like March, I don't know, like 2017 now, I guess. And it was actually like International Women's Day. And I was already off work sick with a migraine. And I tried like one last time to call rape crisis. And they told me again, like, no, we're so sorry, our waiting list is still closed. Please try back in like 3 months. And it was just such a feeling of I don't know. It was just I guess maybe just nothing really, just hopelessness. Like, there's no end to this. I can't. I've done everything that I was supposed to have done to make this right. Like, I went to the police. I carried on doing, I got on with my life. I, you know, I've been reaching out for support. I haven't broken down. Like, I've got on with, like, I, you know, I'm functioning. Like, I'm still going. I've done everything. But there's no, when it's not going to end. Like, how, why isn't it going to end? And I think sometimes I think you just make the decision for yourself that you're just not going to, you're not going to carry on anymore. Like, you're just done. And that was like a, I'm done moment. Like, I just, no. And so, I just told my boss everything. I just, I knew I couldn't go back into work. I didn't want to lie. I wasn't going to, like, just keep, well, I didn't want to call in sick. So I just said, I was like, look, I can't come in tomorrow. And this is why. And it was...
Was your boss a man or a woman? I know that shouldn't matter.
A woman. So, and yeah, that was, like, probably hugely important as well. And, like, I trusted her enough to do something like that. But was obviously also hugely unboundaried. And the, like, you know, obviously needed therapy. Because, yeah, like, I look back on that now and I'm just like, oh God, like, it was just such a outpouring of just like, oh, and, like, I don't know if I would necessarily do that now, because also you can't do that to other people. Like, you need to give people the space to absorb that information, because that's a lot to kind of take from people. But anyway, yeah, I did, and she reacted brilliantly to it, like, contained it and just dealt with it. And all I was wanting in that moment was I don't know, just empathy, like, compassion, just, like, you know, just someone, please, just give me a fucking break. Like, I think that's probably all I wanted. But, you know, I got so much more than that. I got, of course, I got the rest of the week off. Should I want to take it? And and then she arranged for my employer to set up a private trauma therapist for me, and arranged for my employer to pay for it. And I now pay for it myself, but having that set up for me was huge, and it completely blew me away, because I wasn't expecting it. I didn't ask for it. And I would never ever have been able to access it if that hadn't been done for me. That, to answer your question, like, that is privileged. Like, I was working in a job where that could be arranged for me. That was not everyone has that. And if I was working in, like, any other job, then that wouldn't have happened for me. And so it was so important to me that I got that message across, that the average woman can't access the support she needs. Like, she needs to have all these extras, you know. She needs to have work. Yeah, probably in the private sector. Like, what the fuck? Like, no.
I know. When you're describing it, it's like, oh my God, that's so amazing. And then I was listening, thinking, but that should be just the basic for everyone. It shouldn't be that is for the lucky few or the really fortunate. That is what everyone needs. And so that's what they deserve. That shouldn't be a special treatment. That's not
exactly my employer shouldn't have been this, like, white knight, like, right. Like, it's great that they were, and I'm so grateful to them. I'll always be grateful to them. But that it should never, that's what I pay my taxes for.
Yeah. Like, yeah. So we all pay our taxes for. Yeah. I think that's in your writing, what you explained, because you've seen both sides of it. You've seen the help that can be given once there is help, and you've seen that the dead ends when trying to access it, is that you felt so like sorry for all of the people, the men and women who you know are trying to access support that isn't there, because you remember what that's like. And that's what makes kind of campaigning to politicians and making the public aware so important to you. So this is a big question, and you might not have an answer. You're not expected to have an answer. But in terms of like how do we fix this situation? This is a broken situation.
Yeah.
Like, I think, like, how, what are the, do you have any idea of like the steps that we as a society can do to get better, to fix it?
Oh my God. Yeah. Loads. Just start again. I think we're in such a curious time right now, right? Like, this whole pandemic thing has exposed so much of what we already knew. You know, we already knew we were like trapped in there's like a sexist patriarchy, and what we're seeing so much at the moment with the rise of the Black Lives Matter protests. There's so much exposure now around like the systemic racism that kind of permeates through all of our like structures. So like our, just through our economy and through our governments and through our workplaces. Like we can't escape that now. Like there have been, obviously, lots of people have been talking about that for a very, very long time. But now it's so kind of in your face that even like people on the street like can't ignore it. Like we have to talk about it. And so we have to keep that conversation going like across the board. And we need to, because the problems that we all experience, so women, people of colour, like differently abled, like all these people, like the LGBT, we experience problems because our society hasn't been built for us. It's been built top down. And any problems, any solutions that are presented to us, they're not going to work because they're built within the same like racist, patriarchal, elitist society. If you don't experience something, you don't know how are you in a position to know how to solve it. Like you don't get it. Like our solutions need to be community led,
by people who have had experience, by people who either work in the sector or have been through things. You're absolutely right. When I've been talking to sex workers, one of the things that always comes up is that, exactly as you're describing, the government makes policy based on their conversations, never listening to the people ever that it's going to affect, who actually could save them time and money. Like, these are people who are, they're not idiots, we're not babies, but we actually know this, and we know that a little bit of money here saves you all of that money over here. This money, in a day-to-day basis, over 15 years, saves you this. No one's trying to just get, like, handouts. Usually the most cost-effective way to deal with things is, like, you know, prevention, mental health support, helping people take care of their own health. Those things save you money forever afterwards.
Massively. And these are things we've been, again, like these services, these women's services have been saying for years, like for years and years and years and years. And I know for me, from my insight into like the sector, that they are women led, women focused services that, and especially when you get to services that provide very like specialist services to I don't know, women like African heritage women or women of colour services, because they're so specialist. Like you can't generalise those services. But they have to be led by the women who benefit from them, because no other way makes any sense.
Yeah, because you have to understand where someone is coming from, and you have to understand their needs correctly, which means that you do have to be specialised. Yeah. And actually that's interesting, because what it also intersects with is the failures towards men who've been raped, male survivors of sexual violence, and male people who are escaping violent partners. Partly it's odd because it's a situation where men are in the minority, and it's a situation where a lot of the huge conversations are about men as aggressors. So there isn't any room for the men who aren't, that in fact are the vulnerable. And so they're so not talked about that there's even more stigma and shame. There's even less access to services, which would also have to be specialised.
Yeah.
Like, men aren't trying to get access to women's rape services. They need their own. And they need to, because it's completely different, their needs.
Yeah, no, precisely. Even if we look at rape in prison, for example, I was just trying to puff up on my research yesterday. I think it was in The Secret Barrister's book, but I read that rape within sexual assault within prisons has doubled within since 2011, I think it was, and
it's just so awful, and it's so awful that there isn't like a public outcry about it.
Of course,
that it doesn't.
That's huge. Like that's. Because that's the problem. Like it's male dominance, male mass, like this that display of like that power. Because obviously rape is about power. Like we know this.
Yeah.
So if it's that much of a problem, everyone is at risk of this, why aren't we taking it seriously? I think we need to really keep like pressing on that question.
I think so much of it's about listening to people. I think it's too easy to not remind ourselves that the word prisoner has taken the place of woman or man or non-binary person. And so instead you think of a kind of, it's, I think it then has an empathy failure, because you don't think of that as like my uncle, my sister, possibly me. What you do is think there's an other that happens to.
How we just cope with life is by othering, right? Like that's just how we deal with, even with, I think you talk about it in your book a lot, like we other sex workers, we other rape victims, we other criminals, you know, like they're not us, they're the other. And that helps us, just separate us from people who we don't want to be like associated with for whatever reason, either to protect us from harm or to protect us from stigma or.
Yeah, I wonder also sometimes is it like a survival mechanism? Like, is there something about being a human being that means, oh, I can't take in actually how many things in the world are unfair, abuses of power, all the way up to kind of tragic, awful things. So we diminish them in our heads.
Like, oh, yeah. Oh,
the situation in Darfur can't be that bad. I'm sure those Greek refugee camps aren't that oversubscribed. We just end up like omitting. I think that's how the racism and white supremacy has gone on for so long. As we've kind of gone like, I'm sure it's a bit bad with the police. Like we've diminished it to survive. And I think it really happens with rape and crimes about sex, that there's like black and white statistics which say, oh, this happens to 1 in 3 people, or 1 in 3 women has experienced some form of sexual violence or attempted rape. A really high amount of people experience some kind of, you know, like child interference, sexual molestation, and are then coping with it. And then you have these people writing articles for the Telegraph going, it can't be that many people.
Yeah.
And I think, oh, of course, if you've not experienced it or seen it, you assume that, because otherwise the world is full of it. And like, we're here to tell you, the world is full of it. It's full of it.
It's like we're very much like the whole, like, not all men. And then sometimes I'm just like, ooh, really? Are you sure? I know it's not all men.
My ex-boyfriend was very evolved, right? So he was really good to talk to about stuff. And when Me Too came out, we were talking about it, and he was saying it's so hard when people tell you something and it's about someone who's your mate. Like, oh, but I don't see that side of Jeffrey. Like, he's such a great guy. And I said, a lot of the people, a lot of the stories you're hearing aren't people who do this every day. They are a great guy who, like, on one night was someone's worst nightmare. So you just have to absorb that possibility that quite often when someone's telling you it isn't a serial predator, but on one instance, they were pushy or too drunk or not listening, or there's all these levels of it. And I said, you have to absorb that into like human beings.
Like we find it so difficult to see like nuance in people and situations. Like life isn't black and white. And that's very, so a lot of the times how a rape case hinges on as well. Going back to you, your point on we tend to just filter out a lot of the bad things, because if we accepted it, then the world would just be quite a much scarier place than what we want to believe it is. So with like rape conviction rates, for example, they just don't exist. Like, we made, like, they're so pitifully low that we may as well just, decriminalise, you know? Like, we don't, they're like consistently now. Like, when I first started writing about this, like, 3 years ago, it would be like around like 7%. Now it's like pretty much like constantly below, like, not even making 2%. And that's crazy. Like, that's, I can't even get my head around that.
In terms of an injustice, it's the second injustice of survivors. The first thing is the physical assault. And then the second one, which can be even more prolonged, is them, even if they are listened to, even if they do go to the police, absolutely instantly, the fact that there's all of these hurdles where actually they're not told this explicitly, but the behaviour is, we don't care. This other, the rapist is going to be free, or doubt, or it's your fault. And it's like, it's 2020. And I know that there's some areas where the law is trying to get better in terms of like how survivors can tell their story, or training for judges and training for juries. But actually, like with the rape in prison, I feel like we should be in absolute uproar. Like, this should be like taking to the streets going, the system is broken, and it affects so many people. Like, it has to be fixed. We demand it.
Yeah. There is like a lot more kind of conversation about it now, but we can't push it through. Like, so EVOR, for example, End Violence Against Women Coalition, who I did a lot of work with on the petition, that kind of started my campaigning. They recently took the CPS to court, for example, or tried to bring like a judicial review against them for the fall in rape conviction rates. Unfortunately, they weren't allowed to move forward with it. But again, the problem is, we need to have like a very like frank and open and like honest discussion about why the system isn't working in the way it needs to for victims of rape. And a lot of it is, I think a lot of it is because, you know, like the problems we see everywhere else, you know, like sexist, racist, patriarchy.
But Fern, such a huge thing is rape didn't used to be a crime. Basically, rape used to be a crime of like property against men. It's the most patriarchal beginning. So of course it isn't fixed, because so recently, was it 1982? Like, so within my lifetime, it wasn't possible for a man in this country to rape his wife because she was his property. Ha, fact check. I said the wrong date there, talking out of my butthole. It was actually not possible to rape your wife. It wasn't illegal to rape your wife in this country until 1991, a full decade later. A man called Matthew Hale decreed that it wouldn't ever be possible for a man to rape his wife because he owned his wife. So anything he took was rightfully his. And that was something that was, believed and was legally true in our country for hundreds of years. So it's just the tip of the iceberg of this problem.
So I think we need to have like really frank and open, honest discussions about that. And like within that, we have this... The whole criminal justice system is built on the presumption that we have to presume people are innocent, and we tell ourselves that this is the only way to really do it, because you can't go around assuming that everyone's guilty, because you're going to end up with a lot of innocent people in prison. And if that's the way we live our lives, then what is the point of living by any rules at all? So that's like the general kind of like the ground philosophy of just assuming when you're accused of something that you're going to have the benefit of the doubt until that person can prove it. So that means in cases of rape, you have to prove that you've been raped, but you're the only witness.
The benefit of the doubt is too easy, and that's why it can't be tried like other crimes, because even with all of the evidence, it's too easy. And just to create that gap, which isn't to say they're innocent, it's to go, you can't prove that they're guilty, so they go free.
Yeah, and we haven't dealt with it. We haven't balanced the scales really to kind of make that fair. It's not my fucking fault that I'm the only other witness, and that isn't enough to kind of balance things out. Your mind, like, I'm sorry, I can't help that.
Something that I found really shocking, because I had assumed, oh, that must mean if you're raped by more than one person, but actually, because you're outnumbered, so people have experiences where their rape involved two or more perpetrators, are actually even less likely to get a conviction, because it's then you against two or you against three. And so actually it can't be tried like other crimes. It can't be just that.
Yeah.
Because unless your rapist says, I plead guilty, you don't get a conviction.
Yeah. And just the way the whole, trying to work my way through a whole rape victim becomes the evidence, right? She is the evidence. A whole life becomes admissible. It's such a on the one level, like, I'm like, of course I believe in convicting the right people, and I have to believe in like a criminal justice system being like built on the right principles, and like a presumption of innocence, and I have to believe in these good and proper things, right? But when they're so at conflict with what it means to like to just be a woman who exists, where just existing, like just standing still, like in the status quo, you know, it's an attack on your body, on your freedom. It's a cognitive dissonance. I can't like marry these two like things together now. And I think we've been a bit lazy. We've just accepted that the system we have now, that these men created however many years ago, probably was the best and cleverest thing we could have come up with, and we should just leave it at that. And actually, no, maybe we forgot a whole bunch of people when we made it, maybe.
Fern, I think that's such an amazingly astute way to put it. And I think everything that you've shared has been so important. We're talking about our empathy and hearing things and hearing from people. And what you've done is describe not only your work and your thoughts, but how you've kind of got there through your own experience. And I'm incredibly grateful to you.
Thank you. Well, I'm really grateful to you. Like, thank you so much.
I think you're doing just, great work. And I am so grateful to have spoken to you. And I hope you have a lovely afternoon.
Okay. Thank you. You too.
Thanks, Fern.
Thank you so much to Fern Champion. You could hear that it was quite a difficult conversation to have, and these topics are so hard to think about for a lot of us, but also incredibly important. And so just by listening to this episode, I want to thank you, because you're engaging in that conversation and hearing people who want to be heard. And so well done you. I hope you can treat yourself to a nice snack today. And thank you so much for listening to the podcast of Sex, Power, Money. And there's one more special episode, which will be a live episode that I'll put up at the end of September. And it's about sex education. And so obviously that's something that affects absolutely all of us, everybody in society. Thanks so much. Bye.